The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. PAFA has an array of art classes and programs for all ages and skill levels this summer, including day camps for kids, pre-college programs for teens, and classes and workshops for adults in drawing, painting, sculpture, printmaking, and more. Workshops include a masterclass in June with renowned painter and PAFA faculty member Jan Baltzell. Registration now underway for summer classes. For more information, pafa.org/community education.
Today brought a second day of public mourning for Beau Biden, eldest son of Vice President Joe Biden. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Starting us off from WHYY's Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann has more on the viewing for the state's former attorney general.
Hundreds of Delawareans waited in line along the streets of Wilmington's Little Italy neighborhood, waiting for their chance to get inside St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Naya Allen wanted to say her farewell in person.
I just felt that was part of my, it was my duty to, in some way, show my love and respect for him.
Biden's flag-draped coffin was brought into the church around 12:30. Vice President Biden and the rest of the family entered through a side door about half an hour later. Ann Smigelski's house sits directly across the street from the church. She sat with friends and watched the procession of mourners.
You know, he was just a all-around good guy for the state. We feel really bad for his, you know, father, his family, wife, children, and all the entire family.
Deanna Slavinsky was one of many who did not know Biden personally, but came to show respect to what he's done for the state.
It was amazing how many people came out to show their respects. It was amazing. It's a shame.
Carol Lee Benoit does know the Biden family and was brought to tears thinking about what the family has been through.
I have a great respect for the Biden family. They're just so close and intimate with me and my family. And I love them dearly, so I'm out here to pay my respects.
Biden's funeral will be held tomorrow. President Obama will deliver a eulogy. From the Delaware desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
2 years ago today, a Center City, Philadelphia building under demolition collapsed, claiming six lives, injuring 14 more. As WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports, plans to build a memorial park at the site are still coming together.
Rosaline Conti, Barbara Davis, Kimberly Finnegan, Juanita Harmon, Mary Simpson,
and my beloved daughter, Anne Bryan.
In a spitting rain, Nancy Winkler read the six names of those who perished in the building collapse at 22nd and Market Streets. 2 years later, she still misses her 24-year-old daughter terribly.
Anne's death has left a terrible void in our family, which can never be filled.
To help ease her pain and that of others, Winkler spearheaded an effort to build a memorial park here. Mayor Nutter announced the city will kick in $300,000, leaving the project about $300,000 short of the $1.3 million goal.
My hope is that our entire city can continue to try to move together in a process of healing, remembrance, and reflection. And certainly a part of that process begins right here, at this spot, on again this very hallowed piece of ground.
The park will sit on the narrow strip where a Salvation Army thrift store once stood. On June 5, 2013, a freestanding brick wall that was being demolished pancaked onto the thrift store. Survivors and victims' families have filed more than a dozen civil suits. A general contractor and an excavator were each charged with third-degree murder for allegedly contributing to the collapse. Both are scheduled to stand trial in September. I'm Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
With summer beach season at hand, some are summoning the will to lose a few pounds to look their best in bathing suits. Let's look in the mirror with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, is it truly a surprise that Hawaii, with its beautiful beaches, ranks number one once again as the sveltest state in the union?
Well, I don't know if it's a surprise or not, but those are the facts. 19% of residents of our 50th state, Hawaii, are obese. By our measures, our Gallup Healthways measure every night, ask people to tell us their height and their weight, and then we compute their BMIs, and then we look to see which ones would be classified as obese. The other states where residents are fairly svelte are out in the west or in the east: Colorado, Montana, California, Massachusetts, Idaho, South Dakota, and even New York State. Those are the states where we have significantly below average representation of residents who are not obese.
Now let's talk about body mass index in the tri-state region.
New Jersey, where, of course, I work out of Princeton, is slightly below average. 26.2% of New Jersey residents can be classified as obese. That makes New Jersey the 16th state in the union, where one is the slimmest and 50th is the most obese. Pennsylvania, a little above average at 28.6. The average is about 27.7. And Delaware, about the same as Pennsylvania, with 28.5% obese.
Okay, we've tackled the top. The middle, take us to the bottom.
It's the South. We've always found that with a few Midwestern states thrown in. Why residents of the Southern states are more likely to be obese is a fascinating question, which we can't get into now. But if you're in Mississippi, you are much more likely to be obese. In fact, more likely to be obese than any other state in the union. 35.2% of Mississippi residents we classify as obese. And the other ones that are high on the scale are West Virginia, Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Alabama, Kentucky. You see the thread there. States in the South, again, for a variety of fascinating reasons, are the heaviest states in the union.
Frank, let's turn to an even heftier chronic concern for Americans, the economy, and specifically consumer confidence. How is it trending?
Well, it's been trending down, and this is really fascinating because, of course, it dropped through the basement back in 08 and 09, and then we saw in our measure at Gallup of Economic Confidence and others like the Conference Board and the University of Michigan Reuters Index of Consumer Confidence and Sentiment, we saw them going up and going up and going up over the years, and they peaked in our measure in December and then January of this year, and we said, aha, this is good. Consumers are getting more confidence. The recovery is underway. But then suddenly, starting in February, the numbers started coming back down again, and they've dropped. If you look at it, it's like a mountain peak in January, and then consumer confidence starting to come back down again through just this week. We're not sure exactly why, but one thing that we've done here at Gallup, our analysts have correlated consumer confidence with the price of gasoline, and it's a very high correlation. Price of gasoline dropped to as low as $2.04 in February, and that was the height of our positive consumer confidence. Then the price of gasoline on average in the U.S. started to go up. Consumer confidence started to go down. So that may be a very significant factor. We call up Americans. How confident are you in the economy? They say, price of gas is going up. Not that confident.
Let me posit another factor in that mix. A New York Times CBS News poll out this week points to the strength of concerns over growing wealth and income inequality. Frank, are perceptions that the recovery is benefiting the rich more than the masses playing into this?
They could, but that really hasn't changed over time, and that's a real key there. We've talked about it before. When you ask Americans, should income and wealth be distributed more equally, Americans say yes, and we've had that in place for quite a time now. So I'm not sure that there's been any dramatic shift, say, since February in those attitudes that would be correlated with the drop in consumer confidence.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Turning to this evening's headlines, the unemployment rate in Philadelphia declined to 6.5% for April, down from just over 7% in March. Numbers released yesterday by the U.S. Department of Labor Statistics indicates that it's the lowest rate since 1990, though still above the national rate of nearly 5.5%. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's administration today filed a federal complaint seeking to stop a research project off Long Beach Island conducted by Rutgers University. The administration's concerned that the seismic blasts used in the project to map ocean sediment deposits may harm fish and marine mammal populations in the area. Partly sunny, 73 degrees on Independence Mall, it's 6:13. You're listening to NewsWorks Tonight on WHYY. Partly cloudy overnight. There is a chance of showers overnight into tomorrow morning. Tonight's low, 63 degrees. Turning partly sunny tomorrow. Saturday's high, 82. Still ahead.
This is a snapshot of what his heart and mind and being were all about.
A one-man play describes an unusual, often tragic life. We'll have that story when NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Delaware Valley University supports WHYY. With DelVal's Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology, students develop the skills, knowledge, and clinical experience needed to work in the lives of others. Graduates are prepared to apply for the Pennsylvania Licensed Professional Counselor credential. A specialization in social justice or child and adolescent counseling can help make a difference in the community. More about a Delaware Valley University Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology is online at delval.edu/grad.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The clock is ticking on a $25,000 challenge. We only have until June 15th to receive 1,000 pledges. If we can reach this goal, an anonymous donor will give WHYY an additional $25,000 in memory of Hubert J.P. Schumacher. Every pledge counts, so we need to hear from you right now at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Fox Chase Cancer Center is a proud supporter of WHYY. One of the newest advances in the fight against cancer is immunotherapy, a treatment that unleashes your body's own immune system so it can better fight cancer cells. Early results from studies at Fox Chase and other centers show promise, even in patients who did not respond to other treatments. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase Cancer Center now offers next business day appointments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The vast and varied collection amassed by Dr. Albert Barnes in the early 20th century delights visitors to the Barnes Foundation on the Parkway in Philadelphia. A new book focuses on one portion of that collection. Joining me is author and art historian Krista Clark. She is senior curator, Arts of Global Africa, at Newark Museum in Newark, New Jersey. Krista, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks so much for having me.
The book African Art in the Barnes Foundation is the story of the collection and very much the collector. Review what motivated Dr. Barnes to go on this exploration of and fascination with African art.
Well, the story of Barnes' involvement with African art is fairly complex. Part of the story involves his interest in modern art, and I think we know the Barnes Foundation primarily as an institution whose holdings focus on modern and impressionist art from France, from America, and that's really how the Barnes Foundation is known. And many collectors in the early 20th century saw connections between modernist art and the fairly abstracted forms of African sculpture. And so part of Barnes's interest comes from trying to make those connections, but it goes much deeper than that because he had a lifelong interest in and commitment to African American culture, and he saw connections between African American culture here in the U.S. and the aesthetic merits of African sculpture.
Let's note, you're also author of a book entitled Representing Africa in American Art Institutions. And in that context, how would you evaluate Barnes' collection and what he tried to purport through it relative to other museum collections?
Well, Barnes was really one of the first private collectors to look at African art as art. The objects that are in the collection were made primarily for use. I mean, they certainly have aesthetic merit. They were made by artists, but in their context in Africa, they were made for ritual use, for cultural use, and Barnes was really looking at them purely for the formal appreciation. And that was rather new because in the United States and in Europe, objects from Africa were seen as ethnographic curiosities. And so for Barnes, he was trying to shift to an appreciation for the forms of African sculpture and to foster that. And it was really the first permanent installation of African objects as art in the United States. You had a couple other museums that had displays at the time, but they didn't really focus exclusively on the aesthetics of African art.
Though the display in the Barnes Museum is far from formal, discuss how these African pieces were interspersed and still are with other parts of the collection.
Well, what makes the Barnes Foundation unusual is that the works in the Barnes Foundation are displayed in these wall ensembles. And so the African sculpture is on the second floor of the Barnes Foundation, and mostly in three galleries, and is displayed alongside works of Western modernism, works by Pablo Picasso, by Modigliani, as well as works of decorative art, medieval panels, American artist watercolors. So the idea is to make connections and to place African art within a continuum of great art traditions of all time and to give it that sense of prominence in art history, really.
Your book also places his collection in the context of the ongoing Harlem Renaissance at the time.
Yes, that is, I think, one of the things that people will be surprised about this book. Little is known about his role in the Harlem Renaissance, and he really was one of the main collectors who introduced our objects from Africa to very prominent and influential writers, artists in the Harlem Renaissance. He had a fellowship program available to African-American writers and artists beginning in the 1920s. Aaron Douglas, who is known as perhaps the leading artist of the Harlem Renaissance, studied at the Barnes Foundation during a very formative period in his work. And you really see an influence when you look at Douglas's work. You see the influence of his study of African art from the Barnes Foundation collection.
Krista Clark, thanks so much for joining us to shed light on NewsWorks tonight.
You're welcome.
Krista Clark is author of the new book entitled African Art in the Barnes Foundation. She is senior curator, Arts of Global Africa, at the Newark Museum in Newark, New Jersey. You can hear more of our conversation at newsworks.org. Charlie Parker was one of the musicians that epitomized the aforementioned Harlem Renaissance. Parker's virtuosity and complexity changed jazz. This week, Opera Philadelphia premieres a new work that provides another insight into Parker's life that ended tragically at the age of 35. WHYY's Karen Smiles brings us this look at Yardbird.
Surprisingly, there are barely a few notes of Charlie Parker's music in this new opera about his life. It's not a biography, and it happens after he died when his body spent days unidentified in a New York City morgue. Parker's life was plagued with hardship, genius, and a good dose of struggles. For this opera, composer Daniel Schneider starts with what he imagines was the saxophonist's last dream and aspiration.
Because he always wanted to compose classical music, he wanted to study with Edgar Varèse, and he wanted to go to Paris, and he knew Stravinsky and loved his Firebird. So that was sort of a dream that never came true because he died so early, and he also never.
What a night! What a sight!
Yardbird the Opera tells the story in a fantasy mode, kind of a ghost story, in which Parker encounters his mother when he was an adolescent and the three important women in his turbulent life. Librettist Bridget Wimberly says she read everything that she could find about Charlie Parker to make the writing of the story engaging and fresh.
When I found out he was dead in the morgue for 3 days, I was like, well, that's it, because nobody talks about that. Or maybe, you know, people talk about his heroin addiction or his music creation or the jazz, you know, great he was, but the fact that you can lay in the morgue unidentified and essentially forgotten, in a sense, in a way. Your body's there, so where is your spirit? You know, it's gone.
Schneider, well known as a performer and composer in both jazz and classical music, has created all new music for Yardbird.
I know Charlie Parker's music very well. I mean, it's one of the cornerstones of modern jazz music. You have to know his music, and you have to study his music, and it's very addictive music because it's very logical, it's very strong, and once you heard it and once you played it, it's a part of your repertoire. And I always felt very attracted to that. It's very fast music, but it's also very elegant music, and in many ways very perfect music.
That's Schneider on flute, playing a piece of music he wrote for Yardbird. The challenge for composer and musicians was to perform an opera based on the life of a prolific and renowned American musician without using any of Parker's original music.
There are little parts that obviously will be Parker-like, but it's not about Charlie Parker's music. It's my music, and it's something that reflects on Charlie Parker's music. So it's really a different thing from just taking his music and using it for an opera.
The starring role of the legendary saxophonist is played by celebrated tenor Lawrence Brownlee. Opera Philadelphia crafted Yardbirds specifically around Brownlee's singing style.
I love a lot of styles of music, so it's not that far away from things I've listened to my whole life. So I appreciate what he's done for music. But also, it's for me, it's a great challenge, but also a responsibility to bring light to his life.
So a lot of people say his life was a tragedy. We all have to die. But let us die having done something. And certainly Charlie Parker did.
Librettist Bridget Wimberly. I'm Karen Smiles, WHYY News.
And for more on Yardbird and other events taking place in our region this week, check out the entertainment guide at newsworks.org/guide. In 2009, Philadelphia poet, musician, and actor David Simpson decided to write and star in a one-man play about his life as a blind artist coming to terms with success, religion, and family relationships. 3 years later, just as production got underway, Simpson was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig disease, and was no longer able to perform. But the show went on with a friend taking Simpson's role. WHYY's Steve Trader was there for the premiere in Elkins Park, also attended by Simpson.
In crossing the threshold into the house of Bach, Simpson reflects on his youth, his parents, meeting his first love in college, and his relentless pursuit of mastering the organ.
It was intense. It was music, music, music. And whatever you thought you wanted to be, you could be it.
Simpson also reveals his struggle to live up to his mentor's expectations while studying the organ in Paris in the late 1970s. He touches on his lifelong guilt over not believing in God despite his family's wishes. ALS has left Simpson wheelchair-bound and unable to speak well, but he says writing the play helped him come to peace with his own mortality. His twin brother Dan, also blind, also a musician, says it was incredible hearing his brother's life unfold as a work of art on stage.
This is a snapshot of what his heart and mind and being were all about, and I'm happy that he finished it, that he got to be here for it.
Director Mimi Kenny-Smith has known Simpson for 16 years and stayed in touch with him almost daily during the production, despite his worsening condition. She says she would have done anything to make this happen for her friend, who may only have a few months left to live.
You know, he's just so funny, and he's a good friend. He's a great person, and I just love him. I would do anything for him.
The show will run next weekend at St. Mary's Church on Penn's campus. For WHYY News, I'm Steve Trader.
Finally this evening, we're all saddened here at WHYY to learn about the passing of our friend, Reese Pally, at the age of 93. Pally was a lifelong doer, an entrepreneur whose pursuits included sailing around the world for 15 years, operating a hotel, an art gallery, and other businesses in Atlantic City, and writing a book a year since 1984. Speaking to our late colleague, cartoonist Tony Auth, on Newsworks Tonight back in 2012, Pally shared the secret to his vitality in old age.
I've always had an intense desire to be part of the action. I opened the shop on the boardwalk because my dad had a little shop on the side street in Atlantic City, and all the action was on the boardwalk. I wanted to be part of that action. A man must take part in the actions and passions of his time at the risk of being judged not to have lived, Oliver Wendell Holmes.
On that note, here's to you, Reese.
I'm going to live till I die. I'm going to laugh instead of cry. I'm going to take the town and turn it upside down. I'm going to live.
That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from our intern, Maggie Freeling. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
The blues I lay low, I'll make them stay low. They'll never trail over my head.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a longstanding tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, assisted and independent living. A specially designed neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
The Broadway adaptation of the film An American in Paris is up for 12 Tony Awards Sunday. The songs are by George and Ira Gershwin. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Michael Feinstein about the Gershwins and his friendship with Ira, and we'll listen to some great Gershwin recordings from Feinstein's collection. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.